The U.S. Library of Congress wants to hear your stories from South Dakota. From SDPB, today is Tuesday, June 24th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, StoryCorps is coming to Sioux Falls. You are invited to record with oral history facilitators. Bring a conversation partner, bring some questions, share a story that illuminates, entertains, and maybe even changes the way the nation sees South Dakota. We'll talk with StoryCorps' on-site manager later in this hour. But first, South Dakota celebrates two Bush Fellows this year. We will get to know John Little and Lori Puryear as we hear about their big ideas that will have big impact on communities. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're In the Moment, and news is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. The 2025 Bush Fellows have been announced. The Bush Fellowship is a leadership program that helps leaders invest in themselves in order to make impactful change in their communities. The fellowship serves Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the 23 Native nations that share the same geography. Two South Dakotans were named this year, including John Little. You may have heard him on the show before, talking about his work at the University of South Dakota, where he is Director of Native Recruitment and Alumni Engagement. He joins us from SDPB's studios on the USD campus in Vermilion to break down his journey from applicant to fellow.
Just a long, intense process. I don't think I've ever gone through anything like that in my entire life, but it is really intense. But I think the reasons that I wanted to apply for that were, you know, I was fortunate at the University of South Dakota in my current position as the Director of Native Recruitment and Alumni Engagement. I work with a ton of incredibly talented alumni that have graduated from the University of South Dakota. And we've been fortunate over the last few years, Val Big Eagle, Joe Williams, we've had quite a few Native individuals that have won the fellowship over the last few years. And so I've had lots of conversations and really been pushing and promoting to share that when they won it. And so seeing Joe Williams win it a couple of years ago was really inspirational for me. And he's someone that I have a lot of conversations with and really enjoy. And so I approached him last summer and just said, you know, I'm kind of thinking about, like, after seeing your journey, I'm really thinking about applying for this to kind of develop my leadership skills and think about things that South Dakota needs in the future. And so, and Joe was just really, really willing to be helpful for feedback and conversations and kind of give me perspective on his, I guess, perspective for what it was like for him.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, I'm just really appreciative to have had kind of like a mentor like that to really be, you know, I don't know if everyone has that. I imagine there's a lot of people that just go into it kind of blindsided or blindly. And so that was really helpful to have someone that was so encouraging at the beginning.
Tell me a little bit about the benefit of the length of that process, though, because many Bush Fellows come on and say, yeah, it was really hard. It took a long time to go through. The waiting was difficult. The work was intense, but I learned so much about myself and what I wanted to do with the next 2 years that it was worth the process. What was the process like for you, and how did it inform your application?
Yeah, I mean, it is a long process. You learn a lot of patience. I think that's the biggest thing for that is just you're kind of sitting there waiting a lot of the time too, but I really, like, the plan opens up, I think, in early September or so, and then it's open up for about a month or so, if I, you know, I'm not totally remembering the dates correctly, but it's one of those things where it's a quick turnaround, which I'm really appreciative. I knew when it was most likely opening up, but then I knew also that I had to kind of turn around quickly and get things in. And so I think that I enjoyed that part of the process as well. And then it's like also thinking a little bit about, like, you have to have a student who you've mentored or someone that you've mentored over the years, and that, as well as a reference for that too. And so that was something that I had to, like, think about a while too. And I was fortunate to find two really great people for that. And so I think there's just a lot of just thinking about what you want to do with it. And I think when I first started, I was really, really thinking about the, like, kind of wanting to build some sort of organization for South Dakota, but then there was some pushback from people who've applied that I talked to that are like, no, this is for your leadership development. And so it was a challenge for me because we don't often take time to think about how we're going to develop ourselves as leaders. And so It was challenging, and I think that was really, really impactful. And then, you know, there's a long gap period, about 3 or 4 months, where you don't really hear a ton. And then you also have the in-person interviews, which you get to meet with, like, former fellows, but also just tons of really talented people that are doing incredible things. And they're asking you really challenging questions about leadership development and, like, what type of leader you want to be in. And so overall, even if I didn't get it, it is a really rewarding process just to, like, go through that and kind of think about what skills you would need or what things would be useful for you to be, like, the best leader possible in the future.
Yeah, and what those obstacles are. And that can Absolutely. Be deeply personal, of what the obstacles are for you to step into that leadership role.
Absolutely, yeah.
There's nothing quite like having another Bush fellow look at you and challenge you on something that you know. You feel like, yep, you saw exactly who I am and exactly how I'm thinking. I remember talking to somebody about a story I wanted to do, and I was like, I just don't think I can do that story. I think it's just controversial. And this man looked at me and said, but you have a journalism license. And I was... my first thought was like, well, we're not licensed, like, you know, physicians. And then I knew what he meant. And it was like, if you don't do it, you know, what the heck are you doing in journalism? Mm-hmm. Like, that's why we think you're there. And it just really gave me the courage to go forward and say, well, I have a journalism license and I need to do the hard work ahead.
Absolutely. And I think the 9 month thing, you know, reflecting back on it, if you're pitching a vision, you have to think about that vision for 9 months too, right?
Yeah.
And so I think that it's not just like you just came up with a random idea and you're pitching it, and then in a month you maybe get a few $1,000 to fund it or what, you know. It's like,
right,
you're thinking really strategically about it. And then people, like you said, are going to pick that apart and challenge you and ask you, like, why you did it this way. And so I think, yeah, it's very strategic how they do it, and I think it's really impactful for anyone that's applying for it.
What are some of the things that are on your list, areas that you want to move forward to that you think will help grow your leadership?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think one of the biggest things is I've just been looking back at South Dakota over the last few years, and again, part of my role in the Bush Fellowship is, like, wanting to make clear that it's, like, very much separate from my work at the University of South Dakota, but
right,
it's also...
Yeah.
Has some ties to it, right? I think about, you know, developing recruitment networks and all sorts of things for the state, and thinking about college prep. And so one of the things I've noticed in South Dakota the last few years, we've lost a lot of our college prep programs, and some of them are grant funded, and I don't know what the future looks like for those right now with this current administration. But, you know, I think that it's important to think about challenging students to think about South Dakota and higher education in general, but also challenging them to think beyond South Dakota and then creating networks to, like, come back to South Dakota, right? And so I think that's kind of what I want to look at. I want to look at some different programs from across the United States. I actually have a meeting soon with a recruitment network called STARS, which is basically a bunch of, like, higher education institutions from across the Midwest that include Ivies to kind of small liberal arts schools that are, like, partnering together to think about recruiting rural spaces. And so I really kind of want to look at that and kind of think about how to develop a network that can really help South Dakota, but also challenge myself to think outside the box as well too. And so I think that's kind of some of the stuff I'm looking at. I'm thinking about doing some conference travel. So there's a lot of different things that I'm hoping to just kind of really focus on. Networking as a big component of it for me over the next couple of years.
And we're in this time when the idea of inclusive space is scrutinized in a way that is very particular to the time that we're in. So when we talk about why do this work right now, what are some of the ways that you're opening yourself to, like, how do I explain to people that for Native students, in, you know, creating an inclusive space looks like this in the world where the algorithm is trying to pick up anything that, you know, kind of feels like it's not merit-based. So there's real misperceptions and discrimination, and then there's also just this chilling effect of people who maybe want to encourage people but don't quite know how to do it in the current political climate.
Yeah. I mean, I think those are great questions, and I think there's a couple different directions I could go with that. I think the first one is thinking about when people think about South Dakota, they think about us as flyover country. And so, like, when I have developed programming in the past, in fact, like, my wife Megan and I were developing a college fair a few years ago, and someone asked us, it was in the Black Hills, and someone asked us, should I fly into Denver? Is that, like, the closest city to get to you all? And I'm like, if you want to drive 5 or 6 hours, yeah, but it's, You know, and so I think for us, people really kind of overlook us. And I was actually at a conference a couple weeks ago, too, where people said, like, you know, our admissions office kind of has, like, jokes about the Dakotas because we get so few of applicants. And so, like, when we do get an applicant from South Dakota or North Dakota, we get really excited because it hardly happens. And I think for me, I understand the joke, but also it's kind of sad because I think we have a ton of talented students, native and non-native, across the state that, like, could go to, like, a Harvard or could go to a Stanford or could go, you know, anywhere that they want. And I think we're not thinking that, like, outside of South Dakota in a lot of ways. And so I think for me, it's about thinking about how to kind of challenge students to think about that, like, thinking outside the state, but also challenging institutions to, like, not think of us as flyover country, right? And getting them to come here. And I think, you know, there's so many institutions that are curious about South Dakota. And I think for the biggest thing is if you're going to recruit rural spaces, you have to show up to those spaces, right? And so I think it's about kind of getting those institutions to start investing more time and coming into South Dakota as well, too.
Yeah, I think every student listening needs to hear that these institutions, your dream institution, is looking for an applicant from your hometown, even if your hometown is 100 people or is completely rural or is a town they've never heard of, that they do get excited when those students apply. And that can be where the scholarships lie.
Absolutely. And I think the flip side of it is getting people to think about, you know, when I was growing up, Duke was a basketball team. I would have never have thought to have applied, coming from a small town, Winter, South Dakota. Like, I would never have thought to have applied for Duke. And I don't know if I would have had the grades or the scores to get into Duke, but, you know, I didn't try. I never would have thought about trying. And so I think it's about challenging students to start thinking about that. But then again, like I said earlier, I just want to make sure we're also, like, we're investing in students to think outside of South Dakota and change their perspectives and challenge themselves in a lot of ways, but also wanting to come back home to South Dakota, right? To keep people here too.
Yeah. And that education might very well be in South Dakota. We have some really wonderful institutions here, but it might not be in, you know, near your hometown. You might be making a little bit of a trip. Talk a little bit about coming home and taking with you questions about how this education can be of service to your community, I think is huge. To go into your, you know, freshman year, for example, and say, how is the thing that I'm learning going to help my family, going to help the people who are in my community? That's, I think that's enormous.
I stayed in state for both of my undergrad and my master's degree. But then for my PhD, I had to leave the state of South Dakota to go. I have a PhD in history, and there was no options in the state for that. And so I barely left the state. I went over to Minneapolis, and I think about the experience of, like, me living in the Twin Cities for 5 years and realizing, like, I couldn't leave a meeting. About if I was going to a 10 a.m. meeting, I couldn't leave at 9:50 and be early, in a small town. And I was going to have to leave at, like, 9 at the latest, right? And so I think even just thinking about that, challenging me about whole different worldviews. I learned about so many different communities of color in the Twin Cities and, like, a lot of different diversity there, right? And so those perspectives challenged me and changed me in ways that I'm, like, forever grateful to. But I always saw South Dakota still, like, here. And I think that's the same way with our students, of, like, having them go live somewhere and learn about a whole different world for 4 or 5 years. It can be really impactful, and then bring those things back to the state too.
Yeah. One of the things that I heard time and time again through my Bush Fellowship journey from other fellows, I struggled with it myself somewhat, but I found it to be much more pronounced in other, family systems and communities, was the ability to take care of yourself or take time for yourself. So many people came from, refugee backgrounds, for example, and they just, there's no time for that. We need to be pushing forward at all times. So whenever I talk to a new Bush Fellow, I always say, do you have things in place that are going to be nourishing for you to take a break, take a rest, reflect, take care of yourself in unique ways? You don't have to tell me what they are, but have you thought about that, of how you will support yourself in that way? Because it can be exhausting work.
I think I've been thinking about that I think since COVID, I think there's been just all of us need healing, I think, in a lot of ways. And so I've definitely been thinking a lot about that, and I definitely will have like a couple vacation or two planned, and then some just downtime when I do some of the trips and stuff like that. And so I've been trying to think strategically about that, but I also, part of my actual plan was thinking about what sustainable structures look like for, like, if you build a nonprofit or if you're building an organization too. And there's a lot of really interesting examples out there of especially some like native orgs that have different PTO things built in. You know, like we're used to like the 2 weeks worth of PTO, which I don't feel like feels enough for a lot of us. But there's other like national orgs out there that are doing things like planning vacations around like native ceremonies and stuff like that. And so I think just thinking about that long term of like what it looks like to do this work, like an impactful work, but also making sure you're not burning yourself out too, which I definitely have experienced multiple times throughout my career. And so I've been really trying to think strategically about like if I were to build a dream organization 5 to 10 years from now, you know, what practices would I make for myself, but also for any staff doing that work so that they can continue to do that work too.
That's Dr. John Little. He is Director of Native Recruitment and Alumni Engagement at the University of South Dakota. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Lori Puryear has spent more than 3 decades highlighting the power of Native artists as culture bearers, economic drivers, community leaders, and visionaries. A citizen of the Oglala Lakota Nation, Lori served for 25 years as president and CEO of First Peoples Fund, transforming it from a donor-advised fund into a national platform for Indigenous creative and economic sovereignty. Lori Puryear joined me in the Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in Rapid City to share what's ahead for her as a 2025 Bush Fellow. Tell me a little bit about, tell our listeners a little bit about why you applied for the Bush Fellowship. You have a long history of a really impressive and community-changing work. Why did you want to do this program?
Well, actually, I will confess at the get-go here. Mm-hmm. I applied for the Bush Fellowship, I don't know, probably several years ago, mm-hmm. and I didn't receive it. Because I think I didn't fully realize what it meant to invest in myself as the founder of First Peoples Fund and, you know, doing the work inside First Peoples Fund for the past 25 years or so. And during that time, it was less. But since 1999, I didn't know anything outside of that, you know. Yeah. So I didn't, you know, I wasn't ready, you know, when I was transitioning out of First Peoples Fund and my role as the founder. You know, I think I it was an important transition. You know, the fellowship requires that you focus on what it is you want for yourself and not in the context of the current work or place of employment. And so it was important to really go inside, right, myself and focus on, you know, what is professional and leadership growth at this stage in my life.
Yeah.
And then at the recent fellow convening, or when they gathered all of us, one of the former fellows from the Twin Cities area, he said, this is an investment in yourself, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I had to really like fully sit with that again and realize, because he said, you know, he was so worried about looking outside the window and what, you know, other people were thinking, you know, that he didn't even think about like looking in the mirror. And he said, you have to figure out what it is you need from the fellowship and invest in yourself and that it's not a program. Yeah. And so, yeah. You know, 20 some years of writing program grants from Bush Foundation and others, you know, I was really good at that, but I wasn't really good at all, you know. So the second on that other side of me.
Yeah.
So by the time I did apply, I think I was ready. You know, I was in a completely different place, and I think I had a stronger sense of where I was at.
I found so many people would just ask me, you know, what's your project, and I would say again and again, you know, it's not a project. It's a, you know, investment in, you know, this next 2 years, and they could finally, I would just have a couple things lined up that, you know, sort of smelled like a project. And I would say, well, I'm doing this. And they'd be like, okay. Then they could get their minds around it. But it was an incredibly difficult shift for me, but also for other people who were trying to understand, you know, what I was doing.
I hear you.
Tell me a little bit about some of the things at the beginning of your journey, directions that you're hoping to take. Like, where are you beginning?
Well, you know, I really centered my work after 20-some years of working in this thing we call the, you know, community development, the creative economy, and really building leaders, you know, in tribal communities from Alaska to Maine to my own home community of Pine Ridge, and, you know, being able to launch the Rolling Res Arts Bus, you know, for artists, and now the Oglala Lakota Art Space. You know, I didn't, in doing all of that work, you know, I could see some of the missing gaps. So my goal is, you know, in terms of my own professional growth, is to really focus on, you know, impact investing in the creative economy or the creative industry. You know, I know there's the past few years that there's over $1 trillion that supports, you know, the creative economy or the creative industry within social impact investing or social entrepreneurship, they call it. And I, you know, have been to SOCAP in the Bay Area and, you know, a long time of mentoring under Rebecca Adamson at First Nations years back, who spent her whole career, you know, working in this area. And what does it really mean to fully invest in artists who, you know, whether they're in theater, film and media, or even, you know, this new movement towards the fashion industry or the creative indigenous economy around fashion, you know, they need more capital, right? They need more capital to do the work. So I think I can have the time now to really delve into what does that look like in Black and Indigenous or other communities outside the Native or Indigenous communities. And I serve on the board of the Jerome Foundation, and I sit on the investment committee there. And, you know, as well as seen a couple of amazing work happening around program-related investments and how we're able to put some of the percentage of the endowment into, you know, PRIs, you know, within philanthropy, and how can we look at investing in one of these industries in Indian country to lift up culture bearers and tradition keepers, you know. And I also see that, you know, in the whole impact investing side, or ESG as they call it, is there's a lot of work happening around climate change, you know, and investing. But I see our tradition keepers, our First Peoples funds in the past, our Community Spirit Award honorees, they're usually the first to see, like, and have the direct impact, see the feel what's happening in their community, you know, due to climate change. So I want to see how what the possibilities are for looking at, you know, that industry in terms of how does it get more support to those that are the quiet leaders in their communities.
Yeah. Leadership.
Thought to learn.
Yeah. Leadership, you know, means different things to different people. And it just, like you said, sitting with that and spending time to consider what that means for some of the people that you're working with, that in and of itself is a big ask. You know, you mentioned financial and investing, and I'm thinking about money and intention and how hard that is to be intentional with money as a day-to-day, you know, navigating your daily life in the society in which we live. It can be hard to be intentional about spending. How do you work with large groups of people, communities, foundations, businesses, governments, to really think about intentionality with investing in finances in new ways? Because there's all this emotion and structure that is already built around money. Not all of it is supportive.
Yeah, and I think, you know, like I said, there's a lack of support or underserved populations, you know, in communities. And so we're the first to see, you know, and experience these negative implications of, you know, corporations and such coming into our communities, are working out right outside of our communities.
Yeah.
But I also believe that, you know, artists, you know, the creatives have a lot to teach us, you know. Mm. And I learned that just from, you know, the more than 100 Community Spirit Award honorees of First People's Fund, that regardless of what is going on around them, you know, they remain constant and steadfast and, you know, and humble in the work that they do, and they remain in their communities. You know, and I think about small villages in Alaska of 100 folks, and, you know, it's the weavers and the language speakers, you know, that are really making sure that we hold on to those tradition ways, teaches and practices and, you know, our languages and such. And I think that's what the rest of the world doesn't see. Mm. And I just came from this global cultural forum in Berlin and just flew in yesterday, and there was indigenous folks from around the world, and we still have that memory, you know, that memory of who we are, as whether it's in traditional food systems, yeah, you know, or caring or protecting for the land. And we had huge trade routes, you know, from all the way from Canada to Alaska to the tip of Mexico, you know, on this continent. And so I think it's just about you know, reclaiming that memory, you know, and I think the artists, the creatives, yes, there's emotion, you know, in terms of what they do, but I've also seen, you know, some of our artists from the Bush region, you know, Deani Whitehawk and Chanupa Luger and Frank Wan, and, you know, many of these artists who now are receiving these major significant awards, like the MacArthur Genius Fellowship with, you know, Deani Whitehawk, and, you know, so it's really part of it is to help them look at, you know, putting some of that money aside, and how do you invest in your family, and, you know, what type of investments do you, you know, things do you invest in that aren't harming the economy, you know, are harming our communities, and, you know, financial education that the CDFIs do, you know, all of that becomes important when they start getting the significant amount of resources. And then paying the taxes, right?
Right.
Putting some money aside. We always teach the artists, put the money aside, make sure that you're paying your taxes.
Right. What are some things that you're, I want to hear more about Berlin, by the way, and things that you didn't know but you learned from other people that surprised even you with your level of experience?
Well, you know, we had folks from Aotearoa or New Zealand to Papua New Guinea to, you know, the continent of Africa. And, you know, I feel like there's such a more, a stronger global connection due to migration, you know, around the world. And, you know, most of those folks speak two to three languages, you know, and here we are, indigenous folks here just trying to reclaim our own language, you know.
Right.
But we had, you know, three, four languages, French, Spanish, and English, and Portuguese, and then not to mention their own indigenous languages in the room. You know, so I feel like in a lot of sense, a lot of ways that they're, we have more in common when we're on an international experiences, our immersions with other indigenous folks and other world folks than we do oftentimes in our own, you know, this own continent that we live in. Mm. So, you know, it was very humbling in terms of the amount of work we had to do in a very short time period. And Kate Bean, who's Dakota, you know, who's one of the first Native women running American Contemporary Art Museum in Minnesota, you know, we're the two Native women from this continent. And one other family or one other group was coming from Omaha, but didn't feel comfortable with traveling at the moment.
Yeah. For people who, especially artists that you've worked with in the past, and I think this applies to the fellowship as well, but who have come to you and said, nobody's listening. I'm doing this work, I'm taking time,
And I worry sometimes, or I feel frustrated that that no one will hear or no one will care. How are there ways that you have responded to that in the past that you think might be useful as a reflection as you move through some of your new learning pathways?
Well, I'm not sure that nobody's listening. You know, what I find with the probably a couple thousand artists, you know, and I, you know, good, our work at First Peoples Fund started in the Great Plains region because we saw that there wasn't the same opportunities that our relatives were having in the Southwest, you know.
Yeah.
And so, you know, thinking about how far we've come now after 25 years, you know, we can see the success of, you know, our artists like Lauren Goodday and, you know, others who, and result of social media or Instagram and Facebook, you know, that are able to market online, you know, in the old days, we didn't even have that. We were just trying to take a group of artists to the Santa Fe Indian Market or the Northern Plains Tribal Art Show. And, you know, so the heart of our work began here. And I, you know, I can look back now and see, you know, really just the ripple effect of the impact of, you know, their work in this region, you know. And I think the other thing is, you know, we have these waves of downturns in the economy and, you know, just being more creative and how do you diversify, you know, your revenue streams as artists, you know. And we always valued the artists at First Peoples Fund to, you know, if you're going to pay a lawyer or accountant or whatever, that you need to pay your artist as well for their time.
Yeah. So there isn't a sense of self-doubt about the value of the time is what I'm hearing you say. You know, what are some of the obstacles and challenges then?
You know, there's everything's kind of cyclical and seasonal, you know, with Native art too. And, you know, I know right now it is a very, very challenging time that we're in, you know, with our tribal communities, you know, here in South Dakota. And, you know, you can see the concern and the worry, you know, of what's going to be happening or what's currently happening. So, you know, as to how that's going to affect, you know, the artists, I think we have yet to see that. I know that we still, you know, at First Peoples Fund are supporting, you know, with our fellowships and, you know, hopefully those opportunities remain there for them. You know, I know that the Oglala Lakota Arts Space is busy, you know, bringing artists into the space.
That's Lori Puryear, founder of the First Peoples Fund and a 2025 Bush Fellow. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I am Lori Walsh. StoryCorps is coming to South Dakota. Now, this is a national oral history project. Here's how it works. You sit down with a trained facilitator in StoryCorps' retrofitted Airstream trailer, and you record a conversation with a conversation partner, somebody that you have brought along with you that day. StoryCorps' conversations are archived in the Library of Congress. Some of them, with people's permission, are shared on social media sites, and all of us get to listen in on the important ways that people's lives are impacted by sharing a story with someone they care about. StoryCorps is going to roll into Sioux Falls, South Dakota on July 3rd. And so I reached out to StoryCorps site manager Ian Murakami for a look at how it works, how you can participate in it, and really how being in conversation with people has changed how Ian sees the world.
I joined StoryCorps in October of 2023. So it's been about, oh gosh, I think about a year and a half now. I came on as a facilitator. I read about this job in a book. StoryCorps has a collection of stories. It's called Listening is an Act of Love. I picked it up when I was living in Alaska. I picked it up visiting friends in Juneau. I read some of the stories. I was so moved. And on the first couple pages, they say we pick a couple people every year to travel the country and talk to people. And I thought, what an amazing job. And I couldn't stop thinking about it. I remember I was in the airport thinking, what if I just packed up my bags and traveled the country and talked to people for a year? And so I waited, the opportunity came up, I applied, and I got it. And then I came on as a facilitator for a year, Loved it. And then right when I was getting sentimental. I was like 20 years of facilitators and I'm gonna miss this so much. They offered me the job of the site manager. So to help run things, schedule things, do logistics, and still stay in the booth. And I jumped at the opportunity and I've been here ever since.
All right, so what did you major in college? What did you
I
study?
majored in government, political science,
Okay.
and I was really interested in law. And I still am. But I think I was realizing that I wanted to spend more time doing a lot of fun out there things, trying new experiences, and getting as much of life as I could before I went back to school. I really wanted time. And so I moved to Alaska. I lived there for a couple of years. I worked for the YWCA, loved it. And then I started doing this. And so I just feel like, you know, when you're in the booth, you realize that there are so many different ways to live. And it's made me realize I need more time to figure out what all those things are. And so that, you know, if I choose to go back to school, I'll feel really confident. And so it's been so fun. It's been so fun.
Tell people who are listening who aren't quite familiar with how the mobile site is going to work, what you're asking people to do, what kind of stories you're hoping they come and tell, where are they going to go? Give us the big picture.
Yeah. So we are a national oral history nonprofit. We're based in Brooklyn. We were founded in 2003. And our mission is to connect people through the power of storytelling and conversation. Connect people either who know each other or don't, just through the power of a meaningful conversation between two people. And so we have that model. It started in 2003. And our other mission is to capture the stories of America as an oral history organization. What are people talking about, everyday people talking about in their communities? And so we have a bunch of different programs that achieve that mission. But we specifically are the StoryCorps mobile tour. And so we've been running almost as long as StoryCorps has. We started in 2005. This is our 20th anniversary. And we travel across the country in a retrofitted Airstream trailer to 10 cities a month, 10 cities a year, one city a month, roughly. And we invite people to come in and record a conversation with a loved one, family member, someone they have any sort of relationship with, even by themselves. And they can choose to share it in the on our online archive, the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress, and then with radio stations across the country for potential local or national radio broadcasts. So that's kind of who we are and what we do. And our mobile tour, I think, is really founded on the idea that there are stories everywhere and that we don't want to just be listening to New York. We want to go to as many places as possible and listen to what people think are important to them and not what they think that we should be hearing. And so we've been doing that for quite a while. And now our collection, we shoot for, I think, about 1,000 interviews a year. And we do a pretty good job about getting to that number. And our archive is over 380,000 recordings now, 22 years old, 380 plus thousand recordings, almost 700,000 people from all over the country and all over the world. And so I think we've done a pretty good job at achieving that.
So, how many teams are on the ground at one time to hit those
We have a
numbers?
bunch of different initiatives. We have some national facilitators that work for a bunch of different initiatives, but for the mobile team specifically, we have three trained facilitators, and then we have myself, who also comes on and facilitates as well. We have some per diem facilitators who can come on and off the road if needed for coverage. So we're a pretty tiny team, you know. Our full-time, you know, permanent staff is about 5 people running a national oral history tour. And so it's quite a bit of legwork. But it is always really fun and interesting. There's always something new every day, and I think that's what I like the most about the job is you're never bored. You never wake up and do the same thing every day. It's always different people, relationships, conversations, and there's always new ideas and revelations coming out of the booth.
Are there thematic stories that you're looking for this particular stop?
I would say, you know, we don't really have set target themes in each city, and I really like it that way. The recording is intentionally very open-ended. I try to stress to everyone that this is not an interview, this is a conversation between you and your partner. As a facilitator, your job is to keep track of time, monitor the audio quality, and take some brief notes so people can follow along with the conversation. But it's not to interview, and I think that's a common misconception. And because the model is so open-ended, we really can't have set targets that we want to hit. I can say themes that come up really, you know, frequently, which are conversations about family, relationships between family members, friends, coworkers will come in and talk about their vocation, their job, how they became interested in their field of work. People will talk about their town, their hometown, where they grew up, how it's changed, and maybe how they want to see it change, or maybe how they don't want to see it change. And we have a lot of kind of historical recordings, people that are older, that have a lot of life experience, and they want to get that down in perpetuity. And so I would say those are some pretty common themes that show up in every stop. But I think the specifics of those stories are always really unique to each city, which I enjoy.
Yeah. So how do people sign up? Grab a partner, make a plan. How do I get the best experience?
So the best way to sign up is to do it online. So you will need an appointment in advance. You'll sign up at our website. If you just look up StoryCorps Mobile Tour, South Dakota, the link will be right there. You'll sign up online. You'll put in your contact information, give us an email so we can send you your paperwork, give us a phone number so we can give you a call. And in about a couple of days, someone from our team will give you a call and just go over all the logistics of your appointment, anything you need to have ready, answer any questions or concerns that you have, get you ready to go. And then you'll show up for your appointment. It's a 1 hour appointment. If you're a pair, you can record for up to 40 minutes. And your trained facilitator will be in the room with you, helping to guide you through the process. There is no cost. We're really proud of that. There is no charge to record or share a story. We are wheelchair accessible. We have a wheelchair lift and we have a ramp. Just let us know in advance so we can get that ready for you. And you can choose to archive that recording or keep it to yourself. You don't have to share if you don't want to. Sharing is optional. So that's kind of the whole process. I would also say too, for people that aren't familiar, familiar with booking online or having difficulty, we do have a toll-free number that they can call. That number is 1-800-850-4406. So that'll be for people, let me say it one more time, 1-800-850-4406. So that's a number that people can call at any time to help schedule an appointment. It'll show up on our end, and then we'll give you that call back, just like we would if you had booked online. But what I would recommend is if you can book online, you'll get real-time availability. So you'll be able to see, what times and places. So we're open almost every day of the week. We're open weekends. We are open holidays. The only days we're not open is Tuesdays and Thursdays. So we try to work our booth schedule around what's convenient for people. We also offer virtual recording options. If you want to record on something similar to a Zoom call, you can do that as well. If you have a relative maybe who lives out of state or someone who's out of town but really wants to record, you can do that virtually. We'll help you set that all up. And if for some reason you can't even make it in our booth, we have an app. So you can download that on the App Store and you can record with a family member in person. It'll guide you through all the steps using your phone. So we have a lot of different options. I would say, if you get the opportunity to participate, please do. We're here for a reason. We're really excited to hear all the stories.
Yeah, we're going to put all the information and links up on our website as well at SDPB and push things out on our social media. The StoryCorps social media is one of my favorite follows. I follow on Instagram because you share often little snippets of people's conversations that, I mean, they might be short, but don't give a short period of time because they're really impactful. So tell me a little bit about how sharing those stories is part of the mission and how that can impact other people and inspire them to share their stories.
Yeah, so I would say what I love about StoryCorps is that you can choose what you would like to do with your recording. You can share it on the spot, you can sign the release, you can wait up to a year, listen to it first and let us know, or you can just choose to make it private. And I really like that it gives people that agency. We don't have a preference, you can pick whatever you'd like. But for the people that do choose to share, we pick a select few, usually for local broadcasts, with a partner radio station, so South Dakota Public Radio, or for National Public Radio. And so those animations that you see are often picked by our StoryCorps team. And usually they'll focus around some key themes of love, family, connection, right? Or, tie into with historical events or eras, and they seem to be relevant to a wide audience. I think there really is a power to sharing your story. We have, in every stop, we have what's called a listening event. So we invite members of the community who have recorded with us in the past or just the public to come in and listen to the stories from the stop and celebrate our time in the city. And I've watched people who were featured get visibly emotional when we're playing the audio, because I think, maybe these stories are things that people haven't talked about before or they've been scared to talk about. And I think a lot of that fear comes from questioning whether people will care or whether people will listen or whether it's important. And, to receive, I think, in real time, that validation that what you're saying is important and relevant to a wide audience of people that you are watching in the room is really powerful. And so I think that encourages a sense of vulnerability for everyone else in the room. Right. If they're sharing that, I have something similar to talk about. Or, maybe they'll talk to them after the event. I really appreciated you sharing that. I had a similar experience. And like we're saying, it all feeds into that mission of promoting that connection and community through storytelling, through conversation. And so I think it sets a positive example, both for the people that want to share and are a little scared, but for the people that shared that they did what was right for them. And so I tell people too, right? There is no pressure. It is your choice. But also the people that have shared have really gotten a meaningful experience out of it. And I think that's what matters.
For you as a facilitator, have there been moments in the booth where you feel a little spark, where you think, oh,
Oh my
and
gosh,
there it
yes.
is? Yeah.
I love to talk about my conversation. So I've done, I think, over 285 recordings at this point.
Yeah.
So I've done a lot. And I like to say that I remember all of them. Even if I don't remember all the names, when I see their picture, I go, I remember what they talked about. I
Yeah.
remember what happened in the morning. You know, we'll do the sound check and they'll talk about, you know, what'd you have for breakfast? And I remember someone said chicken minis from Chick-fil-A. And I thought, what a fun answer. I've never heard that before. And for those who are curious, the number one answer is nothing. They have
Nothing.
not eaten
Yeah.
breakfast. But I think there are always some really powerful recordings. And I think the ones that I think about a lot are the recordings that leave me with a question, something that I need to think about or reflect on. And so when I was in Lafayette, Louisiana, I had just started doing this job at the end of 2023. I was doing a recording, and it's shared on the archive, so you can listen to it if you would like. And I think his name was Alfie Delahousie. So he was a naturalist and a biologist. He was in his 80s, and his relative was interviewing him about how he became interested in nature and science. And he read the most beautiful poem about the Atchafalaya Basin where he grew up. And he talked about how he was interested in science because he was curious about the natural world, right? Why does the wind blow this way? Which way do the birds go? And talking about the water in such a descriptive way that really moved me. And when we had finished the recording, I had thought, you know, what does it mean to live a life that is led by curiosity? Because clearly this man is so satisfied with his life and what he's done. And it seems like that satisfaction has come that he has followed the questions that have really interested him and, you know, and explored it as much as he could in a way that is both beneficial to other people around him, but to himself as well. And I was thinking about that for a while, and I said, you know, that I think that I'm doing that too. I am being motivated by curiosity and I'm moving into each of these moments with these people and asking those questions. Or when they're done, you know, because I don't want to interview too much or pressure them. But after the conversation, you know, when the mics are off, talk to them about what they just mentioned, right? How do you feel? You know, what do you do now? What are your interests? How have they changed over time? Like asking those kinds of follow-up questions. And I've had some really meaningful connections because I followed that curiosity. And I think I want to encourage people to do that too. You know, if you have a question, ask. So many people just want to be asked. So many people just want to talk to other people. You would be surprised at the number of people that have been waiting to talk about something and just want to get asked. And I think what's so cool about story court is that space is where you can ask and answer and share without judgment in a way that I think is really transformative. So that was one of my favorite ones. Although, of course, I really do love all of them. But that question is something I've thought about pretty much since I got here.
And it's changed your life. And you
Absolutely.
weren't part of the conversation. You weren't, that wasn't your story. It was someone else's story, and yet it was also your story. I love
Yeah.
that.
It invites reflection. I think that's what it is. It invites reflection. The power of a good conversation is it invites reflection to everyone who listens to it. For everyone to look inward. Maybe it shows a mirror, right? Of, oh, I had a similar experience. I wonder how I would have responded. Or, you know, if something similar happened to me, what would I do? What would I explore? What are things that I would really want to pursue? And I think it inspires a lot of people. And that conversation definitely did the same to me.
Ian Murakami is site manager with StoryCorps. Now, if you are interested in telling your story, StoryCorps is in Sioux Falls from July 3rd to August 7th. You can start signing up now for your slot. Find more information, make your reservation at sdpb.org/StoryCorps. Let's keep them busy while they're here, South Dakota. That's our show for today. We hope that it served you. From all of us here at SDPB, thank you for sharing your stories with us, and thank you for listening.